This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The focus in the Bahamas is on rescue and recovery efforts Wednesday after the bulk of Hurricane Dorian finally moved north after causing mass devastation and leaving thousands of people in need of aid. Prime Minister Hubert Minnis, that is, said there were 7 confirmed deaths from the storm, but the number was expected to increase. Forecasters say Hurricane Dorian is moving closer to the southeastern U.S., likely first impacting Florida and Georgia before moving up the coast to North Carolina, where officials are urging people to complete their storm preparations.
The greatest impacts will be felt Thursday and Friday, but we can feel the impacts as early as tomorrow. We urge everybody to complete your storm preparations by tomorrow. The State Emergency Response Team has been filling resource requests for our county partners to include food, water, shower trailers, Swiftwater Rescue Teams, and National Guard High Water Vehicle Teams.
North Carolina's governor ordered a mandatory evacuation of the dangerously exposed barrier islands along the state's entire coast. Dorian battered the Bahamas for almost 2 days, leaving especially the Abaco Island area devastated.
Worse than anything I could have imagined. I went through Hurricane Matthew, which was another strong storm, and, you know, that paled in comparison. So we're happy to be alive, glad that my family is safe, and, you know, we can rebuild. We will rebuild.
Prime Minister Minnis said that a Navy vessel is carrying food to the people of hard-hit Abaco Islands Tuesday night, and more will arrive there on Wednesday. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The United States imposed its first ever sanctions against Iran's space agency, accusing it of disguising a missile program. Iran said its space program is aimed at building rockets to launch telecommunications satellites. UN's Security Council resolutions bar Iran from developing ballistic missiles and anyone from helping it. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam has denied that she discussed resigning with Chinese officials amid growing pro-democracy protests, despite having been heard in a leaked audio recording saying she would step down if she had a choice.
For a chief executive to have caused this huge havoc to Hong Kong is unforgivable. It's just unforgivable. If I have a choice, the first thing is to quit.
But Lam told reporters Tuesday she had not even contemplated discussing a resignation with Chinese leaders. Nevertheless, many Hong Kong residents said the recording confirmed what political scientists and protesters have long believed, that despite Hong Kong's separate constitution, Beijing runs the city. British lawmakers voted to block Prime Minister Boris Johnson from taking Britain out of the EU without a deal, a move Johnson warned would thrust the United Kingdom toward an October snap election. Lawmakers in Johnson's own party, who joined the opposition to defeat him in Parliament, are rejecting his threat to expel them for not backing his government. AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
Boris Johnson has warned any Tory rebels that they would be expelled from the party if they support the parliamentary efforts to block or delay Brexit. One leading critic, former Cheshire Chief Philip Hammond, says colleagues have been so incensed by some of Johnson's actions over the past week or so that they now think it is time to put the national interest ahead of any threats personally to their careers. A no-deal Brexit is considered dangerous because it will sever decades of seamless trade with the single market of 500 million people. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Lawmakers on Wednesday will seek to pass a law that forces Johnson to ask the EU to delay Brexit until January 31st instead of the end of October. South Africa's president condemning days of widespread looting and arson, attacks on foreign-owned businesses across Johannesburg and the administrative capital Pretoria, calling the violence totally unacceptable. President Cyril Ramaphosa said there is no justification whatsoever for people who have a sense that their jobs are being taken by people from foreign lands to attack them, to destroy their properties, and actually kill them. For more news, join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African police say Tuesday's anti-foreigner violence has been contained.
We have arrested over 90 people. I think the figure is close to 100 now. And all of these people are facing serious charges. We are hoping to bring them before court by the close of business on Wednesday.
Vishnandu is the spokesperson for the South African police. We'll have on the scene report about the level of violence and destruction in Johannesburg. Zimbabwe government doctors downed their tools on Tuesday to demand higher pay. And Sudan's prime minister is expected to announce 14 civilian members of his cabinet today, Wednesday.
I know some of the names because some of them were selected in consultation with the FSC, but it is the decision of the Prime Minister on the final say of who is going to be in the cabinet.
Amjad Farid is the spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association, and over 60,000 families are expected to be evicted from Kenya's Masai Mau forest. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on Tuesday condemned days of widespread looting and arson attacks on foreign-owned businesses across Johannesburg and Pretoria, calling the violence totally unacceptable. In a video statement published Tuesday on Twitter, President Ramaphosa says South Africa is completely against xenophobia and will not tolerate attacks on people from other African countries. Meanwhile, South African police say they have arrested more than 90 people in five areas impacted by the violence and that the situation in Johannesburg is calm. Police spokesperson Vishnandu says those arrested are expected to appear in court today, Wednesday.
The situation regarding the violence and the looting, particularly in the Joburg CBD and surrounding areas, have been restored. The situation has been normalized. It was a spontaneous attack that resulted from a flat that was set alight due to a lover's quarrel. And it seems like criminals, just pure criminals, took advantage of the situation and started to loot and damage property. And of course, now the situation has been restored. We have arrested over 90 people. I think the figure is close to 100 now. And all of these people are facing serious charges. We are hoping to bring them before court by the close of business on Wednesday.
And lastly, Brigadier Naidu, there were some who were calling for the army to be deployed to help the police, saying that the police is failing to contain the situation. Do you think that will be helpful at all?
The situation is already contained. As I said to you, the situation has been normalized and restored to its normality. So there's no need to call in additional security forces.
Vishnandu is the spokesperson for the South African police. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of View Zimbabwe Service. Dozens of people were arrested Tuesday in the South African city of Johannesburg after rioters looted shops and torched buildings and vehicles. View's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg saw up close the level of destruction and violence directed mostly at foreign nationals.
At the moment, it is mainly concentrated in Johannesburg, although today also saw incidents in Durban, Cape Town, Pretoria. Basically, though, it's here in Johannesburg today. Police really battled to contain the mayhem. They fired rubber bullets at the plunderers. They arrested many people. Now, in the areas that I visited and where the violence happened today, there are rocks, smoldering car tires everywhere. Everywhere you see shell casings from police firearms. There was also a lot of trouble over here in Joburg in the township of Alexandra. Over there, people hurled rocks at businesses that they said were owned by foreigners. They sang songs to the effect that the Makwere Kwere, which is a derogatory term they use to refer to migrants, should leave South Africa or suffer the consequences. From what I've seen on the ground, the looters are indeed targeting businesses owned by foreigners. However, once the mob mentality takes over, it's sort of open season, so to speak. And the crowds loot South African stores as well and also attack and assault South Africans.
So is there maybe criminality added to all this?
I don't think, despite what the government says, there can be any doubt that foreigners are being targeted. But from what I have seen, there's definitely criminals that hijack the situation and take advantage and start looting, etc., etc. From what I've seen, there definitely is an element of xenophobia. Namibia involved. And, you know, what we're dealing with here in South Africa is that every few months, foreigners who are present in our cities in big numbers get blamed for the fact that locals don't have access to resources, that locals are still poor, et cetera, et cetera. It's easy to blame the foreigners. It's easy to target them rather than addressing the root causes of these problems. We are dealing with a much bigger problem in South Africa, and that is the failure of the government to create opportunities for everyone.
That was VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg, South Africa. Sudan's new Prime Minister, Abdalla Hamdok, is expected to announce 14 civilian members of his cabinet today, Wednesday, following consultations with the pro-democracy group Forces for Freedom and Change. Reports say the list includes Sudan's first female foreign minister, Asmaan Abdallah, and a former World Bank economist, Ibrahim al-Badawi, as finance minister. Amjad Farid, spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association, says Sudanese hope the United States and other Western countries will adopt what he calls a more principled approach in dealing with Sudan by lifting sanctions on Sudan and removing the country from the list of state sponsors of terrorism.
I know some of the names because some of them were selected in consultation with the FSC, but it is the decision of the Prime Minister on the final say of who is going to be in the cabinet.
We hear that for the first time, this will be a first female foreign minister. What does that mean for Sudan if this is the case?
I cannot confirm whether this is true or wrong because this is the decision of the Prime Minister, which will be announced within the coming 48 hours. But what I'm sure of is that cabinet formation will come in recognition of all elements of the Sudanese community, including women.
How much import did the Forces for Freedom and Change have in getting to this new cabinet?
What I can say is that long and deep consultations between the Prime Minister and the cabinet was conducted in full understanding on selection of the name for the cabinet. And the Prime Minister himself was selected by the Forces of Freedom and Change, but he is the Prime Minister of all Sudan, not only of the freedom and change. And there is a wide space of understanding between Dr. Hamdok and the FSC.
A new finance minister, we understand, also has been named, and maybe a former bank official. Sudan will face a lot of economic challenges ahead. What would you like to see from the international community?
I cannot confirm or deny any appointment of any minister cabinet before the announcement of the prime minister. But regarding the international community, and specifically the U.S., they think that we in Sudan are waiting to see a more principled approach in dealing with Sudan. Sudan is faced with a lot of international sanctions because its presence on the state sponsor of terrorism list of the U.S. And Sudan and Sudanese people were never sponsoring of terrorism. This was the previous regime. This was the Bashir regime who sponsored terrorism. And for the last 6 years, the U.S. was opening up to al-Bashir to deal with him as a legitimate leader of Sudan. And in the case of Taliban and Saddam Hussein, the U.S. had to invade Iraq and Afghanistan to get rid of them. Actually, in the case of Sudan, the Sudanese people overthrew Bashir, who was supporting terrorism alone and solely. And so it's very unethical to continue punishing the Sudanese people and the new cabinet for the terrorism that was supported by a previous leader by the U.S. So I'm expecting to see a principled and ethical decision in a very quick lifting of the name of Sudan from that list and full support for the new cabinet to overcome the too many problems and crises that's caused by the heritage of 30 years of radicalization and terrorism and terror.
Dr. Amjad Farid is a spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association. He was speaking with us from the capital, Khartoum. Today's Wednesday, September the 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Government doctors in Zimbabwe went on strike on Tuesday, demanding a salary increase to cover the soaring cost of living. The doctors, like many government workers, say inflation has made it impossible to meet basic needs. Columbus Mavunga has the story from Harare.
With the strike underway, Zimbabwean doctors milled around their quarters Tuesday at the country's biggest hospital in Harare. Peter Gabriel Mugombei, acting president of the Hospital Doctors Association, says doctors will not resume work until the government reviews their salaries, which is less than $200 a month.
We are not downing the tools per se. We are simply incapacitated. We don't have the means to continue reporting to work. The situation is abruptly deteriorated. The employer, last week we had a meeting with the health service body, and they offered 60% of our basic salary and other salary-related allowances, but that's grossly inadequate, because looking at the skyrocketing prices in the market, we actually have, for example, fuel rising by 900%, food by 500%, our rents hiking, and 60% is not quite suffice.
The hospital is now taking only serious cases and referring others to private hospitals. 85-year-old Vasenara Julius is one of those turned away, says her husband, Mariro Aliabi. She has not been attended to. We were asked to go to a private hospital for more tests, says Aliabi. I have sent my kids to go and check how much it costs. It is more expensive at private hospitals. She needs 5 tests done, says Aliabi. With the economy in steady decline, Zimbabwe's social services have been funded lately by foreign donors such as the European Union and the U.S. Agency for International Development. But the assistance has not been extended to salaries, resulting in low morale among health staff. Obadiah Moyo, Zimbabwe's health minister, says the government is aware of the doctors' concerns and has agreed to give them a 60% salary increase, although the workers are demanding more.
So we also expect, you know, that our workers stick to the fact that they are in an essential service. You know, as an essential service, you cannot just wake up and disappear, you know, and leave your patient alone. We have to act responsibly. We have to act in a manner which will not risk patients' lives.
Moyo said Zimbabwe's Health Services Commission will proclaim health care to be an essential service, which will forbid an indefinite strike by health workers. In the meantime, public hospitals are operating on a reduced staff and patients wait for care. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Opposition political parties in Ethiopia say they want changes made to the country's new election laws ahead of the 2020 general election. The coalition of Ethiopian opposition parties say the changes made last month in parliament to the election laws would make it difficult for them to compete. For example, one of the changes raised the number of signatures required to register a political party on the national level from 1,500 to 10,000 signatures. Merera Gudina is chairperson of the Ethiopian Federal Democratic Unit Forum, known as MEDRAC, a coalition of four political parties. He says the opposition is not saying that they will boycott the 2020 election, but it might be difficult for them to participate if their concerns are not addressed.
What happened was that we have been discussing the new electoral law, and several consultations were made between various forces. But at the last minute, outside of the consultation, some provisions were brought in, which created uncertainty in the some of us. But what happened was that only demand the changes brought in at the last minute by the government or by unknown, whatever, unknown group to this new electoral law. And the other thing is that really it's only saying we don't accept some of the changes brought in at the last minute. Otherwise, not a broader consensus reached to boycott the election.
One of the changes is that in order to register a political party, you need at least 10,000 signatures. That went up from 1,500.
This is one of, but the more serious concern is that if a government employee is running for the election, it says he should leave his job on a temporary basis, and that is really threatened most of us. And in fact, when they say government employees, this does not include government officials, elected members now in parliament or regional members of the regional council and so on. So it is really to punish the opposition or to marginalize the opposition. The other is that if you become a candidate of political parties, you should collect about 2,000 signatures to become a candidate. Even at the former notorious Prime Minister Malala Zainawi at least negotiated during the 2005 election, and that provision was removed from the total electoral law. Again, in the last minute, they brought in that provision. So there are some provisions which created, including the one which you are quoting, which created some sort of disquiet among the opposition.
Have you, the opposition, discussed this, say, with the new prime minister or with the Ethiopian Election Board?
You know, we are at the parliament, so-called parliament hearing. We seriously discussed with the so-called parliament committee, and they asked us to give them in writing. We gave them in writing, and we hoped that they take it very seriously. But suddenly, they called an emergency meeting of the parliament and passed it. And I think some of us discussed with the chairman of the new election board, and probably in the meantime, probably would take up with the prime minister. But it was a very sudden emergency meeting by the parliament, which really passed it. We thought the prime minister would consult us, and the parliamentary committee overseeing the law talk to us in a more cordial manner. And we never expected as quick as that, you know. They simply called an emergency meeting and again.
Merera Gudina is the chairperson of the Ethiopian Federal Democratic Union Unity Forum, NUAS Medrak. He was speaking with us from the capital, Addis Ababa. There was drama Tuesday at the Masai Mau Forest in Kenya's Narok County after a member of parliament was arrested alongside two members of the county assembly. This after authorities, a parliamentarian Johanna Ngeno, was plotting to lead a protest against the second phase of the Mau eviction. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, some politicians from the region opposed the eviction of more than 60,000 families from the area.
The three leaders caused drama at the police roadblock as police tried to block them from having a meeting that the police claimed was meant to paralyze eviction of the people from the Mau Forest. Leaders in the region say the government should be considerate of the people living in the area that they claim have land title deeds issued to them by the same government. Narok County Deputy Governor Evelyn Arwasa said that the leaders should solve the Mau Forest issue amicably.
It is time for us as leaders to sit down and solve this problem, and only us sitting around the table will bring these issues to an end.
The government has held on its efforts to reclaim the Thorny Mau Forest, which is the main water catchment area that the government says the people living in the forest have really affected the environment. Environment Cabinet Secretary Kiriako Tobiko said that the move by the government is unstoppable.
And it is not negotiable. And it is either now or never. The importance of Mau is just too obvious. Not just for the county, the region, the present generation, but future generation. There is no dispute about the law. Anyone who sold land to another person in the Mau, pretending to have valid title, is guilty of an offense called obtaining money by false pretenses.
The eviction has received opposition from the political camps as leaders in the region defend the closure of the government institutions in the area, claiming the interference of the school calendar and the socioeconomic activities. Former Bomet Governor Isaac Ruto, who has earlier been accused of grabbing land belonging to the Mau evictees, in an interview with the KTN News, said that the title deed by the people living in Mau Forest are legitimate. However, the environment should be conserved.
But the greatest number of the people living there are third parties. They bought land from the original allottees. It was legitimately or illegitimately given out by the County Council of Narok. And it was supported by the national government by issue, by first of all, demarcating, doing all the necessary survey work, and issuing titles. That is a fact. The other fact is that government has schools there, which they built with government funds. Government has roads in that area. Government have office, various officers. They have been voting there.
The illegal settlers in the controversial Mau Forest started streaming out of the resource on Monday to avoid a major confrontation with the law enforcement officers deployed to execute an eviction order. Arina Tanui, a settler at the forest, says the government should give them an alternative to begin a life. We have suffered enough and we don't want to suffer anymore. Let this be the last day we are suffering. Let's be told what will be done to us so that we live in peace. Already, the Kenya Forest Service officers have camped in Mau Forest areas of Sierra Leone, Nkoben, and Olpusimoru South as they await the expiry of 60-day notice given to settlers that will expire end of October this year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
A Chinese traveler was arrested at Senegal's national airport earlier this week with illegal amphetamines that authorities say were destined for sale in the country. Mohamedou Kane, a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what some experts say is an increase in drug trafficking from China to Senegal.
It's early last week that the Chinese passenger who was flying from China was arrested at the airport with an important quantity of amphetamine.
What would the plans be to do with that amphetamine usually in Senegal?
Actually, this methamphetamine, according to the passenger arrested, it was destined to a shipping crew based in Dakar. But according to our investigation, also came out that the main users of this type of drug remain Chinese themselves in Dakar, in Senegal. These are generally Chinese who are actually involved in heavy labor, like road construction and others. We've learned from our research that some wrestlers are reportedly using it. Yeah, as you may know that wrestling is one of the most popular sports in Senegal, and the stakes are really high.
Is this a new phenomenon in Senegal, and since when? And do we know the amount that it's increased?
We actually don't know the exact quantity that is floating in Senegal, but what we can say that is, like, over the past years, over 16 kilograms of methamphetamine has been seized. This is quite concerning as well, if you know that Senegal doesn't have the tradition of methamphetamine consumption. So from my perspective, I think it is rising and it must be contained.
And the local media talked of a, quote, Chinese mafia. Can you tell me more about what this Chinese mafia, what does that mean?
I think we should be very cautious in using mafia or drug cartel or criminal organization, because the investigation just started and we don't know exactly what's going on. But what is sure is there is a growing market in Senegal and the Chinese are the main consumers of this methamphetamine. Now, who are behind it and how this is organized, we don't know.
That was Mohamedou Kane, a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. That's it for this Wednesday, September the 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Colotti and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.